you know, his reward that he had done his previous deeds with, those will be doubled, or he would get a double reward than the reward of a person who wasn't rich, maybe. For Allah has said, then the Imam, he quotes that same verse that we spoke about in the beginning. He says, it is not your wealth, nor your children that will bring you close to us in nearness, except those who have faith and act righteously. It is they for whom there will be a twofold reward for what they did, and they will be secure in lofty abodes. Fil ghurafati aminun. Right? So, you know, this is something that, you know, we need to take care of. A lot of us, you know, majority of people are not extremely wealthy, right? And there are people, great people, good people, good believers who are very wealthy. Sometimes we look down upon them, we complain, and we, you know, even if we don't say anything, we might, you know, in our hearts, we might look down upon them for their riches. Whereas, you know, the fact of the matter is, it's possible that they are, you know, a lot better than us, a lot more virtuous than us. And if we were given the same wealth, we might be worse than them. Right? So keeping in mind this beautiful hadith, we need to kind of refrain from doing this. It's also interesting to note that in this beautiful hadith, the Imam, you know, he kind of emphasizes the fact that if a person wants to get this double reward, he has to maintain, first of all, maintain good relations with his kin, not only his kin, but also other fellow believers who are not his kin. Right? Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at rich people in the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This Monday. Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
What are the biggest news stories to come out of the Palestinian occupied Palestinian territories? Maybe hard to answer that, but it shouldn't. Hard because mainstream Western media did not cover the daily killings, assassinations, home demolitions, illegal detentions, and Al-Aqsa mosque desecration. Well, the list is rather long, but in this edition of the Spotlight, we will review some of the important and noteworthy events covering Palestine and the Israeli regime and how the new administration, headed by Benjamin Netanyahu, spells bad news for Palestinians for this new year. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Mohsen Nakhli joins us. He's a human rights activist. Joins us from Houston, Texas. And Charlotte Cates, international coordinator of the Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joins us from Vancouver.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Mohsen Dahoui, let me first start with you. It was a toss-up in the list that I had between number one and two, and I must say the list was rather long. But I'm going to go with what I put as number two, but I think it should be number one, and that is the daily raids and killings that have happened in the occupied territories by Israeli regime forces. Really, the focus started to unfold starting in March when you saw what was called a Break the Wave military campaign by Israel. And they included these raids and mass arrests and killings. The focus was on the Jenin refugee camp and also in Nablus. And, of course, it amounted to a year that had the most Palestinian deaths, which was around 240, give or take. Why do you think this year marked the year for so many Palestinian deaths? And if you agree, if that should be the number one story coming out of the occupied territories.
Right. So Nablus is a very unique place. That's where we also have the Lion's Den, and the famous Shaheed, the Lion of Nablus, was also recently martyred by the Israeli regime. And the reason why there's such a huge focus on the West Bank and on these occupied territories, which technically are self-governed by the Palestinian Authority as per the UN resolution, is because primarily we see a wave of defense, a wave of retaliation from the resistance forces in the West Bank and the Jerusalem areas of occupied Palestine. And so to counter and to crush the morale of these resistance forces, which is obviously slightly different from the resistance that Israel has faced from Gaza, the Israeli regime seems to have a focus on West Bank to really kill the morale of the Palestinians who are living in those areas, and to really somehow to really crush the resistance forces that are rising up in occupied Palestine, in Jenin, in West Bank. And it is, and I'm sure you're going to cover this in this talk further as well, that this is in clear contradiction to the intent of the United Nations. That goes on to also show that the Zionist regime has no respect of international law. They have no respect of the United Nations even.
Looking at one particular incident, Charlotte Cates, you had 10 Palestinians that were killed by Israeli security forces in a matter of one day. And then you had the European Union foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, come out saying that, you know, he's greatly concerned about the increasing level of violence in the occupied West Bank. So my thing is, first of all, when you have 10 deaths in one day, if I were to say that, or you were to say that to any common person, perhaps, they would not even be aware that that happened, maybe. At the same time, when you have the EU foreign policy chief making a statement like that, it shows the divergence that has kind of been the custom. Condemn something, and the next day probably is not even aware that he did come out and say that, because that's just the thing to do when you're talking about Palestinian lives. Why do you think that is?
Well, the fact is that the European Union, just like the United States, Canada, Australia, and other imperialist powers, are aligned with the interest of continuing to perpetuate a Zionist occupation in Palestine and affecting and providing essentially a military base for imperialism in the region. And so, you know, the European Union, if it was serious about actually taking some kind of action to put a brake on this ongoing onslaught of war crimes and crimes against humanity and extrajudicial killings and mass imprisonment, not to mention the installation of this openly fascist government in the Zionist regime, then they would do something like impose sanctions on the Israeli occupation regime. After all, we see the European Union and the United States not hesitating to impose sanctions on peoples and countries around the world who are simply defending their own right to self-determination and independence. But instead, in the case of the Israeli occupation, we see the European Union rewarding Israel with access to funding, with access to research and development funds, and with preferential treatment through the EU-Israel Association Agreement for Trade. So the European Union has set itself up as a full partner in these crimes of the occupation against the Palestinian people. This does not actually reflect by and large, the views of the population in Europe. What it does is it reflects the interests of imperialism instead. And, you know, that disconnect is why we're actually seeing a growing level of activism and mobilization to demand the boycott and isolation of Israel, and especially among young Palestinians in the diaspora, who are a growing population in Europe.
One of those deaths out of the around 240, most in Napoli, was one that made the news, and it made the news in a big way. And that was the assassination that I'm going to call of the Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. The footage that came initially that showed what happened, well, it didn't show what happened. It was the aftermath. But then they actually had the reenactment that was done. And beyond a shadow of a doubt, it showed that, you know, that's Israeli sniper targeted Shireen Abu Akleh. Where do things stand now regarding that? I mean, you had Israel whitewash it. You had the U.S. back Israel. And they said that that investigation was not, in their eyes, 100% complete in accusing the Israeli sniper to have committed that crime. Again, it shows another case where Israel gets away with it. Why do you think Israel gets away with it?
Well, first of all, this is not the first time that Israel has committed the crime of knowingly and intentionally killing a journalist. It's quite clear from all the evidences that are now available that the sniper definitely knew exactly that he was targeting a member of the press, a journalist. Yet there seems to be no repercussions against the Zionist entity. It's quite clear now that over the past years we've seen that the United Nations is biased. We've seen that countries who claim to be so-called flag bearers of human rights always tend to ignore the violations of the Zionist regime, the violation that the Zionist regime commits against the innocent Palestinians. So obviously this was big, this news was big, but then the silence of mainstream media, even, for instance, it's absolutely despicable. And I would really go on to really reiterate the fact that mainstream media outlets remain silent, but then other media outlets on social media or TV channels such as Press TV, when they come out and present these kind of news or other news outlets that tend to commit to present these news that aren't available on mainstream media, for some reason they start getting banned on in different countries. They start getting banned on social media. Their channels start getting banned. So clearly, it's an extremely obvious roadmap to how mainstream media and the powers to be are trying to censor independent voices, and one way by killing innocent journalists.
Yeah, I'm sorry to have interrupted you there. There is a notion out there, perhaps, Charlotte Cates, that Israel may be having a point in terms of not being completely guilty, whether it's from the assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh or when Palestinians are killed. But correct me if I'm wrong, and I finally brought up what I was looking for, which was roughly, well, I'll give you a date on this. This is going back to the beginning of the year, when the then prime minister, I'm not too sure how many prime ministers Israel has had, there's so many, but the then prime minister Naftali Bennett, actually, after there was an attack in Tel Aviv that killed three Israelis, he said to the security forces that you can have the full freedom to act after that happens. Full freedom, which is one out of many cases where, from the top down, there are orders that are given to kill Palestinians. I think another great example of that would be the right of return, where Palestinians were targeted and the Israeli forces were given carte blanche to target them. Not only medics didn't escape that, but also journalists. Is there any doubt as to orders coming from the top down to kill Palestinians?
Yeah, these are not isolated one-off incidents. It's not the case where every single day there's another isolated incident, whether it's the assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh, whether it's the killing of Palestinian children, whether it's the torture of Palestinian prisoners like Samer Arbid. These are not isolated acts that are committed by one bad apple. These are part and parcel of Zionist policy, and they have been for 75 years. It's nothing new in many ways. I mean, what we're looking at is these are not just isolated incidents that happen separately from one another, but are part of a process of an ongoing Nakba that has been taking place in occupied Palestine since 1947, 1948, and really before that, through Zionist colonialism sponsored by British colonialism. There's an imperialist war on the Palestinian people and a settler colonial project that is built on attempting to take more and more Palestinian mm-hmm. land and displace more and more Palestinian people. And so all of these crimes are part of the Zionist project itself, not a deviation from it.
Sure. Well, the Zionist project has many projects, and I think one of them is one of the ones that are probably one of the oldest, but it's continuing. And not a, really a word is said about it, Mohsen Naqvi. It's quite amazing, and that is the siege on Gaza from the year 2007 up to now. What is that, 16 years at this point? I mean, they do call it an open-air prison, but maybe Israel wants it that way. Why do you think that doesn't get coverage the way that it should? And at this point, when you have all these Palestinians that are locked in there, so to speak, what are the gains that Israel has? Unless its gain, unless its purpose is hoping, which it hasn't happened, for the democratically elected government ruling there of Hamas to be overthrown by the people within, which, again, there are no signs of that happening.
You see, the tactics that are used by bullies is to instill fear. The only way that a bully can remain in power is if they instill fear in the minds of the people. And clearly, Israel has miserably failed. And the first time that their tactics were failed openly and were recognized by the international community was when they lost to Hezbollah in 2000 and then miserably lost again in 2006. It is then that the spider's web was truly unveiled, and Israel came out as a very weak entity in West Asia. And I feel countries like Syria, countries like Palestine, Iraq, Iran, for instance, they have proven to the world that Israel has become weak. Israel doesn't have any power. The role that Israel has played as the policeman on behalf of the West in that region, they have failed to do so. And now Gaza is a prison, yes, but Hamas is a popular government, a successful popular government within that region. They have armed themselves, and they are resisting now. They're resisting with missiles. And it's a shame on the Arab leaders, on the UAE. It's a shame on Saudi Arabia that they still want to go and they want to shake hands and they want to recognize Israel as a nation when innocent Muslim Palestinians, Christian Palestinians are being miserably killed by the Zionist entity. Every single maneuver that the UK, the US, the Zionist regime have tried has miserably failed. And now this is the last nail that they have formed a government with extremist fascists under Benjamin Netanyahu, under Bibi. And the UN resolution talks about giving self-determination to occupied Palestine. And then right after that, in the recent elections, and we see people like Ben-Gavir literally running the politics of Israel. So one can only imagine the atrocity that one will face. But as I've mentioned before, that these atrocities will only give a rise to the defense forces and to the retaliation that will come from the resistance forces against the Zionist regime, and it will make them weaker than before.
Yeah, there was a number of topics there, Charlotte Cates, that Mohsen Naqvi touched on. And I guess I'm going to go with the UNGA resolution, which made a case to refer Israel to the ICJ. I mean, that sounds great, doesn't it? But Israel is not a signatory to the ICC. Israel, at the same time, the UNGA does not have in its charter any type of enforcement that it can do over Israel in terms of even a cooperation. So that's just good on paper. Really, that's what that is. It's good that it's getting highlighted. But how are you going to have anything really happen on the ground to change the facts?
Well, one of the things, that's been the case, especially with the referrals to the International Criminal Court, the ICC, has been that there has been a tremendous amount of pressure exerted by the Western powers in order for even this very limited mechanism to be reduced even further. for its ability to actually do anything about the Zionist war crimes actually kind of limited even further. And so we're seeing, for example, from the British prime minister, from the Germans, from the United States and elsewhere, a concerted policy to actually block the ICC. And note, of course, all of these countries are also countries that refuse to be held accountable for their imperial crimes at the International Criminal Court as well. Indeed. Because instead, they want to preserve these international mechanisms as actually simply a place where the imperialist powers can drag leaders of nations that refuse to bow down to the dictates of imperialism before them. So there's not really an intention of having justice here. I mean, of course, at the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, in 2004, we saw that there was already a ruling about the illegality of the apartheid wall. This was 19 years ago now. And so now there's another referral for an occupation and colonial project that's been happening for over 75 years. While it can be worthwhile to fight in the courts, we know that it's actually the Palestinian resistance that is changing the balance of power and posing a real challenge to Zionist control of Palestine and to the Israeli occupation. And so we see that even these kinds of purely legal mechanisms that are simply based on, you know, standard tenets of international law are viewed as completely unacceptable forms of resistance. So when even going to court is viewed as a form of terror and labeled as such by the Israeli occupation regime, I mean, we can see that they've labeled multiple organizations that are essentially Palestinian lawyers' organizations working to bring some kind of justice, that there's no alternative for the Palestinian people but to resist by all means that are necessary and available to them.
We got just a few minutes time, and we got so many more topics to cover here. I'm going to go with one that I believe needs to be highlighted, Mohsen Naqvi. This is how an incident is covered by mainstream media, such as the UK-funded BBC or CNN, which is obviously carrying the U.S. line. It said, in this case, CNN, the Palestinian Health Ministry said that at least 10 people were killed, including a 5-year-old girl and a 23-year-old woman. Another 75 were injured, and then it says Israel insists most of those killed were militants. So you're getting this incident covered in the way that it is, but putting that last sentence in there so that it covers the fact that you had 10 people that were killed, and one of them was a 5-year-old girl.
Right.
Is the narrative that Israel, with its influence on the media, have any buyers out there even now? After all the crimes that they have committed?
Well, this is, and the example that you've given is one. When we bring in Hollywood, when we bring in the TV shows that are shown in the West, the Arabs are portrayed as militants. The average Arab is portrayed as a militant, as someone who is a hijacker, who hijacks planes, is a terrorist. That's the narrative that has been built, right? And to add that word militant changes the entire context of that news. And this is exactly this the word game that the Zionist regime has been playing through its stooges, stooges like the owner of Sky News, stooges like the Rothschilds, who have always given a narrative that supports the Zionist line. And this is exactly what we see when Sheikh Qasem Soleimani was martyred. A sitting general of a sovereign nation is killed in a sovereign country by an outside force, and the entire mainstream media remains silent. Not one word of criticism. What if something like this would have happened to a general within the Zionist entity? One can only imagine what BBC and CNN would have said.
Sure.
So the bias is clear now. The bias is clear. International law has failed. The United Nations has failed.
Last question, Charlotte Case, goes to you. There has been a growing Palestinian armed resistance that has happened, and we have seen this past year for that to be emboldened through their acts. And I must say that they're not related to any of the resistance groups. They seem to be just homegrown, or they've concocted their own group out of obviously the frustration that they're having based on the occupation and their rights being violated. And these new groups, again, refuse to align themselves with any specific party or movements. We saw, for example, the twin bombing that happened was a pretty in Al-Quds was a pretty intensive and complicated operation. Do you think that that is going to increase this coming year and maybe take the form of one kind or another of another intifada?
One thing that I just want to note, that all of the Palestinian resistance organizations are part and parcel of the Palestinian people and are created and sustained through the sacrifice and commitment of Palestinians to fight for liberation. And so, of course, it is only natural that Palestinians will continue to create and evolve organizations that are engaged in resistance, to build united fronts and a united resistance front, bringing together those that are engaged in resistance from different political trends. This is absolutely something that is going to continue, whether we call it an intifada by a number, you know, the first intifada, the second intifada, or not. What we are seeing is an ongoing popular uprising that is in many ways becoming more and more comprehensive.
Thank you very much. We're fresh out of time. Do appreciate that. Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator, Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Mohsen Nahmi, thank you. Human rights activist from Houston, Texas. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Yikava Tawai and the team. It's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم واتقوا الذي أمدكم بما تعلمون
And fear he who provided you with that which you know.
أَمَدَّكُمْ بِأَنْعَامٍ وَبَنِينَ
Provided you with grazing livestock and children.
وَجَنَّاتٍ وَعُيُونَ
And gardens and springs.
إِنِّي أَخَافُ عَلَيْكُمْ عَذَابَ يَوْمٍ عَظِيمٍ
Indeed, I fear for you the punishment of a terrible day.
Brothers and sisters, as you were with us in the previous episodes, we have reached the 132nd verse of Surah Al-Shu'ara. وَاتَّقُوا الَّذِي أَمَدَّكُمْ بِمَا تَعْلَمُونَ أَمَدَّكُمْ بِأَنْعَامٍ وَبَنِينَ. Be in awe of him who has succored you with what you know. He has succored you with cattle and children, وَجَنَّاتٍ وَعُيُونَ, and gardens and springs. إِنِّي أَخَافُ عَلَيْكُمْ عَذَابَ يَوْمٍ عَظِيمٍ. Verily, I fear for you the chastisement of a great day. So, these verses altogether make the third part of the statements of Hud. He explains the divine blessings to the servants, to his people, so that in this way he can somehow stimulate that sense of thanksgiving in them, so they might understand the concept of monotheism more, so that they might return to Allah in better terms. And the fact that the Almighty Allah has bestowed on all of us material capitals that we can use because we have human power, that we can use that capital, this meaning has been repeated in different verses of the Holy Quran. Now, some might ask why the Almighty Allah mentions An'am at first and Baneen in the second part. He has succored you with cattle and children. This seems a natural sequence. It does not mean that properties are more significant than children. For example, in chapter Isra, the Almighty Allah says, "And we assisted you with wealth and children, and we made you a numerous host." So mentioning the word an'am, or cattle at first, does not signify priority of cattle and capitals over children. This is just a natural sequence because they were given those cattles at first, and then the children as blessings of the Almighty Allah afterwards.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء لي الدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So, dear listeners, after the Almighty Allah says that Prophet Hud mentions some blessings of the Almighty Allah to them, he goes on and says, وَجَنَّاتٍ وَعُيُونَ. So, أَمَدَّكُمْ بِأَنْعَامٍ وَبَنِينَ. He has succored you with cattle and children, and وَجَنَّاتٍ وَعُيُونَ, and gardens and springs. This means Allah gave you green gardens and fountains full of flowing water, and thus He, subhanahu wa ta'ala, enriched your lives both from the point of human power and agriculture, breeding livestock, and the means of transportation, in such a way that you did not feel any deficiency or inconvenience in your lives. You were given everything you needed. But what happened that you forgot the bestower of all these great bounties? Every day and night you sit at the table of his blessings, yet you do not recognize him, subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this is what is meant implicitly by mentioning these different great blessings of the Almighty Allah to the ibad, to the servants. So what he did actually was that he somehow stimulated this sense of thanksgiving, so that by piety they can be thankful to the Almighty Allah, because everybody knows how much the grace of Almighty Allah has been bestowed on him. And the next point is that now we understand how much grace and blessings of the Almighty Allah were given to the people of Hud. بِكُلِّ رِعِنْ آيَةٍ. They had so many palaces in the highest places. And along with that, they had an'am, they had cattle. وَجَنَّاتٍ وَعُيُونٍ. They also had gardens and springs. Yet they did not want to recognize the bestower of all these great blessings. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Imam Khomeini's viewpoint on condition of leadership. The person who governs should have a wide knowledge of law as it is referred to in traditions. A leader should be perfect in religious beliefs and morals, just and spiritually not polluted with sins. The individual who wants to take the responsibility for applying the Islamic penal code properly to control the Muslims' assets and country's expenditures and wants Allah the Exalted to delegate him the administration of his servants' affairs should not be a sinner because Allah the Almighty does not allow a tyrant to have such a power.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the mosque. In one of his speeches, he mentioned that these mosques should be centers for proper training, and thanks to God, most of them are such. Now, in this part of his speech, obviously, he's talking about the usage of the mosque, the usefulness of the mosque. And he says that the mosques should be the centers of proper training. What do we mean by training? Obviously, we know that the Islam gives importance to the family system, to the individual life, to the social life. And all these things, where do we learn it from? Obviously, we can learn it from the mosque. Earlier, we could see that the children, they used to go to the mosque, they used to learn, even get the education from there. They used to learn the alphabets, the mathematics, the sciences, everything from the mosque. Look at the scientists that we have, Ibn Hayyan, look at the other scientists, Avicenna. So when we look at all these scientists, they were the Muslim scholars, basically. And later, one of them has become the father of algebra, the other became the father of the philosophy. So all of them were the scholars. So the training center where they were trained were the mosques. So we need to take back mosques to the same point, that mosques should not be just a place to just pray five-time prayers, whether it should be a place of training where we can train kids, our children, our generations, where we teach people, where we can teach people how to be a good person. The ethical issues should be discussed. In the structure of the Islam, when we talk about the Jumma prayer, there are two parts of Jumma prayer. There are the two sermons. The first sermon is about the ethics, about our spirituality, about being God-wary, about taqwa, how to be a good person and how to be a useful person in the society. This is all taqwa about. The second part is about the social issues, the political issues, the issues that people have in that town, in that country, in whole world. So basically, the structure of the mosque and the structure of the prayers even, it's been designed in a way in Islam that it takes us towards the best training that we may seek in different institutions. Maybe we are ready to pay to get some trainings, whereas Allah has made mosques the centers of trainings, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day,
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Afghan people from different walks of life have gathered at Iran's cultural center to mark the third assassination anniversary of anti-terror commander General Qasem Soleimani. Participants expressed sympathy with the Iranian nation, saying that General Soleimani was a hero for the entire region.
The pain and grief of the loss of the great martyr Soleimani does not only belong to Iranians. Sardar Soleimani is the hero and flag bearer of the fight against terrorism in the region. He played a very significant and decisive role in our world.
It's the duty of the Muslim world to call for justice for General Soleimani. This huge crime, the killing of a Muslim Iranian general by the U.S., should be investigated by the U.N. Commander Soleimani was targeted by the U.S. when he was busy fighting international terrorism and U.N.-designated terrorist groups.
Participants also said that Commander Soleimani played a key role in the defeat of the Daesh terrorist group in West Asia and in the fight against international criminals.
Commander Soleimani, as a commander of Islam, was there for Muslims everywhere. He was active and supported oppressed people in Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and Bosnia-Herzegovina. Likewise, he was involved in a fight against the arrogance in Afghanistan, too. He trained and directed Afghans to defend their soil against invaders and maintain their freedom. Commander Soleimani fought in a campaign for the freedom of Muslim Ummah.
Along with other admirers of General Soleimani, Afghans every year commemorate the legacy and life of the anti-terrorism hero. Afghan people have long been fighting for their freedom. They remember General Soleimani as a leader and a role model for them and for all freedom seekers. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The Iranian army's radars have spotted a hostile UAV flying 25,000 feet above its southern waters. Its mission was to strike sensitive Iranian military facilities. The army quickly operated its homegrown Talosh missile system, and this is what happened to the intruding drone. This scenario was part of the last phase of a large-scale military drill held over an area stretching from the Strait of Hormuz all the way to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean.
The drills cover a 3 million square kilometer area. They aim to test the preparedness of our young personnel and our military equipment that have recently been added to our fleet. Our military might send the message of peace and friendship to our neighbors, but to our enemies, it's a show of power and deterrence.
The three-day maneuver saw the deployment of several pieces of domestically built equipment, from drones and missile systems to warships, submarines, and tanks. The country has been building up its defense arsenal against the backdrop of the West's arms embargoes on Tehran. The army says today it is capable of protecting the country's land, air, and sea borders using locally developed hardware.
All of the systems used in these maneuvers have been developed domestically. They are designed to hit targets at different altitudes. These exercises show that we, as the Air Defense Force, along with other branches of the Army, are fully capable of defending our country using military technologies that have been fully developed domestically.
The Army's Air Defense Force also used its Mirsad missile systems to strike hostile air targets. The Army says it's working on more advanced missile systems to further bolster its deterrent power.
Engages all of the four branches of the Iranian army, including its air defense force, which has deployed its latest homegrown missile systems. The army says this is to boost synergy between its different units to be ready to confront any potential threats to its territorial waters. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drill.
The
The Center for Political and International Studies of the Iranian Foreign Ministry has organized a specialized roundtable focusing on the fight against terrorism and extremism in the West Asia region. Guests and attendees from different Iranian institutions and bodies took part in the forum, which concentrated on efforts made by the Iranian anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Among the most significant topics discussed during the meeting were fighting terrorism in the West Asia region from the point of view of international law, the role of General Soleimani in fighting terrorism in the West Asia region, and the role of the United Nations in fight on terror in the West Asia region. On the sidelines of the meeting, Iran's former ambassador to Iraq, Iraj Masjidi, highlighted the late commander's role in neutralizing terrorist groups in neighboring countries.
When Lieutenant General Soleimani was assassinated, I was working as the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Iraq. He would frequently travel to Iraq in order to confront the ISIS terrorist group and help the Iraqi armed forces and Hashd al-Sha'bi with planning and logistic support. In other words, he played a prominent role in Iraq in the fight against terrorists.
Masjidi also said that efforts to bring a prosecution against those involved in the assassination of General Soleimani continues. In this regard, the head of a special Iranian committee tasked with pursuing the case of General Soleimani's assassination in domestic and international courts said an indict on the assassination will be announced soon. He was referring to a report by a UN expert on extrajudicial killings concluding that the targeting of General Soleimani and those accompanying him constitute an arbitrary killing for which the U.S. is responsible.
Iran has had a significant role in the fight against terrorism in the West Asia region, particularly in Iraq and Syria. And Iran's top anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, played a pivotal role in combating terrorism and defeating Daesh. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Brits are still reeling from the impact of 2022. It's hard to recall a political year that's seen the country lurch from one crisis to the next, all bookended, it seems, by the saga of which particular Conservative Prime Minister was in charge. Boris Johnson had managed to cling on to power despite mounting evidence presented that his position had become untenable. His missteps during lockdown, dubbed Partygate, a faltering economy exacerbated by the outbreak of conflict in Ukraine, made his departure an inevitability. The race to replace him was brutal, exposing the deep divisions within the Conservatives. Party members chose Liz Truss over Sunak before, but that was only the beginning of the saga. Analyst Chris Bambury was following events closely and reflects on that period of chaos.
We had this strange interim where Liz Truss beat Sunak, clearly showing that a majority of the Conservative Party membership were not going to vote for Sunak for reasons which I think are fairly obvious, which I never really talked about. But Truss was a disaster. And then we ended up with Sunak being shoehorned into the Prime Ministership with no actual election.
I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
Ah, the blink and you'll miss it Truss era. 7 weeks of chaos which saw the pound take a hit and the markets recoil at the sheer ineptitude on political display. There was a sense that the UK's political landscape had now become a running joke.
The chaos of the Liz Truss premiership, you know, was just awesome. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that in British politics. British politics is supposed to be about stability. It prides itself in selling itself, Britain, as a brand to the rest of the world that has been politically stable. This was like Italian politics, you know, and prime ministers just coming and going. This did not give a vision of Britain as a stable political entity.
Not content with topsy-turvy politics, the UK's longest-serving monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, passed away aged 96, leaving the UK contemplating its colonial legacy. With King Charles III with Camilla, Queen Consort, by his side, it was a new era, but one filled with old uncertainties.
I shall strive to follow the inspiring example I have been set in upholding constitutional government and to seek the peace, harmony, and prosperity of the peoples of these islands.
Despite the passing of the baton, the impact of Brexit, the stalemate in the north of Ireland, with the cost of living crisis biting, Prime Minister's in tray was bulging. 2022 is also the year Britain saw a re-emergence of strike action across a multitude of sectors.
We have been reasonable, but it is impossible to find a negotiated settlement when the dead hand of the government is presiding over and blocking a resolution in these talks.
We are seeing the recovery of industrial unrest, workers taking trade union action, and finding that when they go on strike, they are popular, that people sympathise with them, sections of the working class and indeed the middle class. And I think that spells trouble ahead. These strikes, we haven't seen anything like this in Britain really since the days of Margaret Thatcher. This is new, and I think people are learning new habits, new skills of taking industrial disputes. And I think potentially this is a bit of a game changer down the road.
Rishi Sunak and the rest of his Conservative government will be desperately hoping that there is not a repeat of the past tumultuous year. A 12-month period that's seen record number of Brits slide into poverty. But analysts are warning that desperate changes need to happen because so far it seems the Tories are heavy on excuses and light on solutions. On the cusp of a new year, there are many challenges awaiting the average British family. Whoever is in charge in Downing Street, it's the most vulnerable who continue to pay the heaviest price. Without firm solutions from the political class, it seems the upcoming period might hold still more pain for those who can ill afford it. Amina Taylor, London.
South Korea plans to significantly boost military spending over the next 5 years, an annual increase of nearly 7%. The Eastern Asian country aims to spend over $440 million on anti-drone weapons alone. The announcement comes only days after North Korea flew drones into the South's territory for the first time in 5 years.
According to South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff, Monday, five North Korean drones crossed the border before breaking formation. Four of them headed to islands in the West Sea, while one of the drones continued south, reaching the skies over the outskirts of this city, the capital, Seoul.
It was the first such incident since 2017 when a drone crossed into South Korea and photographed a U.S. base here. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, a conservative who came to office in May of this year, has blamed the previous progressive government's policy of engaging Pyongyang for the recent incident.
Given that efforts or military training to respond to such UAV drones have never been properly done since 2017, I think our people must have well seen how dangerous a policy relying on the North's good faith and peace agreements would be.
South Korea plans more joint military exercises with the U.S. for 2023, although much of the public wants talks with North Korea and a de-escalation of tensions. Meanwhile, North Korea has unveiled new goals for the country's military. Addressing a large committee meeting of the ruling Workers' Party, leader Kim Jong-un indicated on Wednesday that the country will continue its military development in 2023 after a record year of missile testing. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Italy's far-right government is about to adopt a security decree that will introduce a compulsory code of conduct for NGO-run ships rescuing asylum seekers in the Mediterranean Sea. Since day one of its mandate, the Giorgia Meloni government has pledged to press ahead with an agenda aimed at stopping what it calls irregular migration. The new measures will force NGO-run ships to deliver rescued asylum seekers to port immediately, without waiting to pick up more people at sea or transferring asylum seekers to larger vessels. Under the new rules, rescued people will also have to apply for asylum in the country where the NGO-run ship is flagged in. Italy's Interior Minister Matteo Piantedosi has said the new provisions